Good morning, Africa. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a French rights group files a case against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Well, we're hoping that this will start to chip away at impunity for these sorts of horrific crimes against journalists, and not just in Saudi Arabia.
Also ahead, the latest in Myanmar's protests.
Police fired live ammunition to disperse a crowd in the northwestern town of Kale, where several people were wounded.
Plus, mining pollution in Greenland. These stories and more are next. Our top story today, media monitoring group Reporters Without Borders said Tuesday it had filed a criminal case with German prosecutors targeting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and others over the killing in Turkey of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
The complaint alleges Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and several top aides not only committed crimes against humanity against Saudi-born journalist Jamal Khashoggi, but are also responsible for what they say is widespread and systematic persecution of journalists in Saudi Arabia. The Paris-based Reporters Without Borders, or RSF, says it chose Germany because its laws allow prosecution for some crimes committed outside its borders. RSF's Director of International Campaigns, Rebecca Vincent, said the complaint also accuses the Saudi government of what it calls the arbitrary detention of dozens of journalists.
Well, we're hoping that this will start to chip away at impunity for these sorts of horrific crimes against journalists, and not just in Saudi Arabia, but elsewhere. So if this German court does take action, we believe that this could be truly game-changing and starting to chip away at that impunity.
Khashoggi, who was a columnist for the Washington Post newspaper, was killed at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Saudi Arabia denies the crown prince was involved, and a Saudi court sentenced others for Khashoggi's death. Both the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and a U.N. special envoy have directly linked the crown prince to the killing. And the Biden administration recently released an unclassified intelligence report that concludes the Crown Prince, known as MBS, approved the operation to kill or capture the journalist.
I think the publication of the U.S. intelligence report just underscored further the need for actual, like, detailed information about what's happened and accountability.
If the German court fails to take up the case, Vincent said, RSF will continue to push for what it considers justice. A trial on Khashoggi's death is ongoing in Istanbul, and RSF is an observer in the court. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
It's been nearly 4 months since fighting broke out in Ethiopia's Tigray region, but much of the area has been cut off from aid groups despite dire warnings that people are starving to death. One of the worst-hit cities in the conflict is the ancient town of Aksum, where Amnesty International says hundreds were massacred by Eritrean forces. Asmara denies the allegation. Eritrea is accused of supporting the Ethiopian government's fight against rebels from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The British charity Save the Children says it is one of the first aid groups to reach displaced families in Aksum, as Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
Save the Children says it is one of the first aid agencies to reach displaced families in the Tigrayan town of Aksum in Ethiopia. The organization released video shot on February 8th showing the distribution of food, shelter, and sanitation to those displaced by conflict. Save the Children's communication manager, Christiana Martin, filmed this message from a school that has been turned into a camp.
The conditions are really terrible. They are overcrowded. There are up to 30 families living per classroom. We're hoping today that the aid that we distribute, the essential food, will see these families through for the next month. As of yet, none of these IDPs have received any humanitarian assistance. Save the Children are the first on the ground.
Aksum is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, famed for its tall obelisks and ancient churches. It has also been the site of some of the most brutal fighting in Ethiopia. On Friday, Amnesty International accused Eritrean forces of killing hundreds of civilians in northern Ethiopia over 24 hours last November, an incident it described as a potential crime against humanity. Eritrea has rejected the accusations. But an Ethiopian state's human rights body issued a statement that also described such killings, though with fewer details. It was a rare official acknowledgement from Ethiopia that Eritrean troops participated in the conflict during the government's crackdown in the Tigray region last year. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government declared victory over the Tigray People's Liberation Front after its forces withdrew from major cities and towns at the end of November. However, low-level fighting has continued in some parts of Tigray.
That was Reuters' Lauren Anthony. Meanwhile, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, is calling on Ethiopia to release journalists and media workers arrested by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government and allied troops. The CPJ says at least four journalists and media workers were detained recently in Tigray's capital of Mekele in response to their attempts to cover the conflict. The arrested include one local journalist, two translators with Agence France-Presse and the Financial Times, and a BBC reporter. CPJ's Sub-Saharan Africa representative, Muthoki Mumo, said in a statement, quote, "The scarcity of independent reporting coming out of Tigray during this conflict was already deeply alarming. Now the Ethiopian military's arrests of journalists and media workers will undoubtedly lead to fear and self-censorship," end quote. And in Myanmar, police continue to fire on anti-coup demonstrators. This as the country's neighbors are urging it to stop using force and to release ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Lucy Fielder of Reuters reports.
Myanmar police opened fire and used water cannon to disperse protests against a military coup on Tuesday, as foreign ministers of neighboring countries, ASEAN members, held talks with the junta via video call and pressed it to release ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi and stop what Singapore called its disastrous use of lethal force. Police fired live ammunition to disperse a crowd in the northwestern town of Kale, where several people were wounded. Protesters threw things at advancing police, a witness said. Hundreds of protesters, many in hard hats and clutching makeshift shields, also gathered in the main city of Yangon, chanting slogans against military rule. Some set up barricades, and police used stun grenades and tear gas. Supporters of democracy have criticized Tuesday's intervention by ASEAN, which has a policy of non-interference in each other's affairs. A committee of ousted Myanmar lawmakers declared the junta a terrorist group and said engaging with it could give it legitimacy. At least six journalists have been arrested since the coup 1 month ago. "Help, don't shoot me," says this Democratic Voice of Burma reporter, who live-streamed police firing near his apartment on Monday night before they seized him. The ouster has drawn condemnation and sanctions from the United States and other Western countries. Nobel Peace Laureate Suu Kyi appeared at a court hearing via video link on Monday and looked in good health, one of her lawyers said. She hasn't been seen in public since the coup.
That was Lucy Fielder of Reuters. In the U.S., FBI Director Christopher Wray testified on Capitol Hill Tuesday amid scrutiny over the agency's handling of the January 6th riot. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has the latest on lawmakers' investigations into the pro-Trump insurrection.
For the first time since the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol, one of the nation's top law enforcement officials telling lawmakers Tuesday that riot was domestic terrorism, fueled in large part by white supremacist groups that represent a serious threat in the United States. Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Christopher Wray.
It has been the biggest chunk of our racially motivated violent extremism cases, and itself the biggest chunk of our domestic terrorism caseload overall, and the most lethality over the last decade has been from these same extremists.
In his first testimony since the attempted insurrection, Wray said the rioters came from a broad range of groups supporting white supremacy and militia violence, and that there is no evidence for allegations they were fake Trump protesters or disguised left-wing protesters. Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Christopher Wray.
while we're equal opportunity and looking for violent extremism of any ideology, we have not to date seen any evidence of anarchist violent extremists or people subscribing to Antifa in connection with the Sixth. That doesn't mean we're not looking, and we'll continue to look, but at the moment, we have not seen that.
More than 270 people have been charged to date for their roles in that riot, and the FBI investigations are expanding, said Ray.
With more subjects being identified and charged just about every single day, the FBI is committed to seeing this through, no matter how many people it takes.
Many Republicans arguing the domestic terror threat is equaled or surpassed by left-wing extremists, such as Antifa, citing the burning of a federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon, last summer. Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
In the past year, we have seen massive rioting and violence as extremists, many of them leftist extremists, took to the streets across the country.
But Democrats pushed back, arguing lawlessness accompanying some pro-racial justice demonstrations pale in comparison to violent white supremacy. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Senator Dick Durbin.
It is not equivalent to a violent attempt to overturn the results of elections, nor is it equivalent to mass shootings targeting minority communities. This false equivalency is an insult to the brave police officers who were injured or lost their lives on January 6th.
In a House hearing last week, Capitol security officials revealed they had not received a January 5th FBI bulletin warning of possible violence. Ray declined to speculate on how security precautions might have been altered if that warning had been read.
You know, I really want to be careful not to be an armchair quarterback.
Negotiations for a commission that would investigate the attacks and recommend security precautions have stalled as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pushes for more Democrats than Republicans to sit on that panel. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA. The U.S. on Tuesday imposed sanctions to punish Russia for what it describes as Moscow's attempt to poison opposition leader Alexei Navalny with a nerve agent last year. The sanctions are on 14 entities and 7 senior Russian officials, including the head of the FSB Security Service. The move marks a sharp departure from former President Donald Trump's reluctance to confront Russian President Vladimir Putin. Before the U.S. announcements, Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov said Moscow would respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions over Navalny, the Interfax news agency reported. Navalny, 44, fell ill on a flight in Siberia in August and was airlifted to Germany, where doctors concluded he had been poisoned with a nerve agent. The Kremlin denies any role in his illness and says it has seen no proof he was poisoned. Navalny was arrested in January on his return to Russia and was jailed last month for parole violations on what he says are politically motivated charges. Bunny Wailer, the last surviving founding member of reggae group The Wailers, passed away Tuesday in St. Andrew, Jamaica. His manager said the 73-year-old died of complications from a stroke he suffered in July. Born Neville Livingston, Bunny founded the Wailers in 1963 along with Bob Marley and Peter Tosh before embarking on a solo career in the late 60s and 70s. He won 3 Grammy Awards and numerous other honors for his music. Tributes have poured in, including from local reggae artist Brian Paul Welsh, known by his stage name Black Hero, who said, quote, Ja B was a vanguard, always pushing the boundaries of expression, whether in song, in style, or in spoken word. There was and can only ever be one Neville Livingston, end quote. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Amnesty International has released a new report that says hundreds of civilians have been killed in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province by an armed group known locally as Al-Shabaab and by government security forces and a private company hired by the government. For more on the accusations, VOA's James Butte spoke to Brian Kastner, who is a senior crisis advisor for Amnesty International and one of the authors of the report.
The situation in Cabo Delgado is extremely serious, and it's getting worse almost day by day. Brian, so basically your report describes three groups in that theater of conflict: the Mozambique Security Forces, the private militia, who you said are fighting alongside the government, and the armed opposition known as Al-Shabaab. It seems your report is suggesting that all sides are responsible for the violence.
It is definitely true that all sides are committing war crimes, and all sides are committing different kinds of war crimes based upon their intentions. It's not our aim to lay more or less blame on any one group. What we do try to do is explain why we think the fighting is happening, and that's longstanding grievances, local people with longstanding frustrations about their political, economic, social, and cultural rights, poverty over generations, long-term underinvestment, lack of education, access to electricity.
When you talk about Al-Shabaab, sometimes we read about jihadists or Muslim extremists. What's the difference here? Are there Muslim extremists in Mozambique, or the relationship to this Al-Shabaab?
That's a good question. So the armed group, we call them Al-Shabaab because that's what the local people in Cabo Delgado call them. They call themselves other names. One of those is that in 2019, they did pledge an oath to the Islamic State. And so they are technically part of the Islamic State Central African province. However, I do want to stress, in our research, these are not outsiders that have come to Mozambique. These are locals that speak local languages. They are well known to the communities in which they are fighting. We had some people that we interviewed say it was very confusing because they recognized the fighters and they weren't sure who was fighting whom.
Why do you think Cabo Delgado has become this fertile ground for the conflict?
Yes, Cabo Delgado is often called Mozambique's forgotten cape because there have been so many years of the central government. Unfortunately, there is this resource curse that we see in other parts of the world where there are gemstones, rubies in particular, in Cabo Delgado. Liquid natural gas was discovered in 2010. There are outside international oil companies, energy companies, that are setting up extraction industries in Cabo Delgado. And the local people have seen outside companies come in and extract the wealth without getting any benefit for themselves. Combine that with a lack of education and a lack of other services, and it's really an obvious breeding ground for an insurgency.
Did Amnesty travel to Cabo Delgado, or how did you go about researching this report?
That's a very good question. So because of COVID, I myself did not travel to Cabo Delgado, and we did not send other researchers there. We conducted all of this research remotely using secure communications. All of the 79 people, internally displaced people that we spoke to, we have kept their names anonymous for their own security reasons, because there's a history of reprisals from the Mozambican government, from people that talk about the problems in Cabo Delgado. But what we also did was conduct what we call an open source investigation. We looked at videos from the region, photos from the region. We have photos and videos of Dyke Advisory Group's operations, of torture and executions by the Mozambican security forces. And then very importantly, we did a lot of satellite imagery research. Where we were able to map the homes that were burned to the ground in these villages and towns. And that really confirmed, you know, the testimony research we got from talking to the displaced persons.
Brian, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, and thank you for your interest in this report.
That was Amnesty International's Brian Kastner speaking to VOA's James Butte. U.S. naval forces are visiting Sudan for the first time in decades following Sudan's removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese officials cheerfully welcomed the missile-guided destroyer USS Winston Churchill at Port Sudan Monday. In a news conference, the top commander of Sudan's naval forces, An-Nairi Hassan, described the visit as a momentous occasion. Hassan says Sudan is happy to receive the USS Winston Churchill destroyer. This visit is historic after 30 years of severed relations. The visit has big implications and represents the resumption of the Sudan-US relationship and the return of the warship visits. The United States removed Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism in December, after nearly three decades of sanctions stemming from Sudan's support for Al-Qaeda leaders in the 1990s. Officers from the U.S. African Command visited Sudan 2 months after the Trump administration lifted the sanctions, and they expressed an interest in military-to-military engagement. The visit by the U.S. Navy began on February 24, when the first U.S. ship in decades arrived at the Sudanese port. The Director of Maritime Affairs for the U.S. Navy's Sixth Fleet confirmed the U.S. and Sudan's interest to build a partnership between the two countries' armed forces.
The reason I am here is because I want to learn more about your country and develop partnerships with your Navy. We have many shared values. I am honored and humbled by the progress that the Sudanese people have made over the last couple of years to work towards democratic principles. We support that, and that's part of why I'm here, to reinforce those values. But the main reason I'm here is to become friends with our Navy counterparts, and I look forward to the work ahead.
Simultaneous to the U.S. Navy visit, a Russian warship has docked at Port Sudan. Russia is waiting for Sudanese government approval to build its first Navy base in Africa. Neba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The global COVAX vaccine distribution plan aims to deliver hundreds of millions of COVID-19 vaccines to low-income countries, many of them in Africa. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The world's largest, fastest, and most ambitious vaccine drive is ramping up, the head of the World Health Organization says, with 11 million vaccine doses arriving Tuesday in Angola, Cambodia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. Between now and the end of May, said WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the COVAX facility will deliver 270 million doses to 142 participating countries and economies. The global initiative was set up last April to ensure that poorer nations aren't left out of the worldwide scramble for vaccine access. The program, which is projected to cost about $11 billion, is funded by donor nations, foundations, and corporations. It is part of the Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator, a global collaboration that works on development and production, as well as equitable access to tests, treatments, and vaccines. Last week, the West African nation of Ghana became the first to benefit from COVAX, receiving 600,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Among the first recipients were President Nana Akufo-Addo and his wife, Rebecca, who received their shots on national television Monday in what he said was an effort to boost public confidence in the vaccine. Akufo-Addo says he plans to have the rest of the country vaccinated by the end of the year.
The world has seen already the great value of the COVAX facility. COVID-19 is a global problem. It requires a global solution. Unless every country is protected, no country will be safe. We all fell together. Let us all rise together.
Tedros says while the vaccine deliveries are good news, he's thinking much bigger.
When the history of the pandemic is written, I believe that the ACT Accelerator and COVAX will be one of its standout successes. This is an unprecedented partnership that will not only change the course of the pandemic, but will also change the way the world responds to future health emergencies.
Officials say the next step is to bring vaccine manufacturing to Africa. Currently, most vaccines available to the continent come from the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, the Serum Institute of India. Akufo-Addo said Ghana is working on a plan to manufacture vaccines locally. And John Nkengasong, head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said the African Union will meet next month to discuss how to do this as a continent.
All of that speaks to the need for our own ability to stand up and say that we, as a people of 1.2 billion people, will continue to invest in our own health security, our economic security that increasingly is being threatened by COVID-19. It is in this perspective that we look forward to working with all countries that will be receiving this COVID vaccine to ensure that they are distributed effectively, provide the appropriate support from the Africa CDC and partnerships that will enable us to distribute these vaccines in a timely fashion.
This vaccine rollout, Nkengasong said, is the first step in a long journey. But in this voyage, he said, the African continent is finally keeping step with the rest of the world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Greenland has huge resources of metals known as rare earths, which are used to help power equipment such as wind turbines and electric vehicles. But mining for the metals has an environmental cost, as Francesca Lanag of Reuters reports.
The Green Revolution is putting Greenland under pressure. The world's biggest island has huge resources of metals known as rare earths,
key components for powering wind turbines and electric vehicles, including Tesla cars. Warming temperatures are melting away ice sheets, making Greenland's riches more accessible. And the surging demand for EV batteries has driven more miners to the Arctic island. Two Australia-based mining companies are racing for approval to dig. One is seeking funding from the US and the other is backed by China, which dominates the global production of rare earths. Each mine would cost about $500 million to develop. One of them would not involve any nuclear material. The other would produce radioactive material and export the uranium to China. Many Greenlanders, while concerned about pollution, feel mining is key to develop their fragile economy. The self-governing territory of the Kingdom of Denmark has a GDP of around $3 billion. Its people live mostly on fishing and grants from Copenhagen, and the government has been keen to attract foreign investments. Expected annual royalties from the Chinese-linked rare earths mine is around $245 million per year. That's equivalent to roughly 15% of public spending. Even though it won initial support from the coalition government, it recently ran into strong opposition, including from residents of the nearby town of Narsaq, worried about A, radiation, and B, their access to indigenous territory they rely on for hunting and fishing. The island may ultimately back either project, both or neither. But the contest underscores that even green power has a polluting side.
That's Francesca Lanaga of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, we leave you with a clip from the late Bunny Wailer's 1976 song, Dreamland. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For over a decade, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his ruling party Fidesz have been working diligently to tighten their control of the country's media outlets and independent press. Through the use of state advertising money, closures, and purchases of media outlets by proxies, the Hungarian government eliminated most of the unfavorable news and comment that was critical of it. In 2018, nearly 500 outlets were rolled into the Central European Press and Media Foundation, a group headed by people close to the Fidesz party. In March of last year, an ally of Fidesz purchased 50% of the company that manages Index's Advertising, Hungary's at the time market-leading online news outlet. In July, Index's editor-in-chief was fired, leading to mass resignations of Index staff. Then in September, the government agency responsible for media oversight declined to renew the license of the last major independent commercial radio station, Klub Radio, a news and talk station. Both Index and Klub Radio were critics of the government. Klub Radio appealed the decision to the courts, but on February 9th, a judge ruled against it. Klub Radio went off the air on February 14th, although it is still able to broadcast on the Internet. Over the last few years, the Fidesz-controlled Media Council and the government have one by one blocked off every remaining avenue for Klub Radio to remain on air when its renewal was rejected for politically motivated decisions, said International Press Institute Director Scott Griffin. The result was that when the time finally came for Klub Radio's license to be renewed, its fate was all but sealed. The United States is deeply concerned about declining media pluralism in Hungary, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a written statement. The United States shares the concerns of international press freedom advocates and many Hungarians over the decline of media pluralism in Hungary. The United States believes that a diversity of independent voices and opinions is essential to democracy, and we urge the government of Hungary to promote an open media environment. The United States is committed to strengthening our partnership with Hungary, a NATO ally, and advancing the Biden administration's commitment to supporting democratic institutions, human rights, and the rule of law.
That was